You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and the places of Southern California. Hey there, I'm Steve Chiotakis, and we start today in the Baldwin Hills area on the balcony off Kelly Lloyd's apartment. Since the beginning of the pandemic, Lloyd has fallen behind on her rent. She says that's a first for her.
I'm fastidious about financial business. You keep stellar credit, you pay your bills. This is, you know, a way of life. It's a feeling of safety and security to be able to pay your bills and to be able to work to do that or make ends meet.
Now, a lot of renters are in Lloyd's shoes. Otherwise financially responsible, the pandemic has put them behind on rent. They've lost income, but stayed put because of local and state eviction protections for tenants who have been affected by COVID-19. Still, they're on the hook for everything they owe. For Lloyd, that adds up to about $10,000. Well, now the state of California is about to start paying off some of that debt with a new assistance program for low-income renters. Will it help Kelly Lloyd? KCRW reporter Anna Scott is here to talk about it. Hi, Anna.
Hey, Steve.
So the state is about to issue some rent relief. That is obviously good news. They're putting billions of dollars, $2.6 billion, in federal rental assistance into this, and they're passing it down through local governments. What is Kelly Lloyd's situation right now?
Well, it's like a lot of people's situations right now. Before the pandemic, she had a couple of sources of income, but both have suffered because of the pandemic. She's a single mom. She has two kids who are school age. She was receiving child support from her ex, but she says that stopped when her ex's income suffered because of the pandemic. And she just started training as a realtor, but then had to stay home for her kids' virtual school. So she still has a roof over her head, but can't really afford it and feels stuck right now.
Where are there cheaper places to live? This is a rent-controlled unit, right? How do you go obtain a place with no real job? How do you come up with a deposit when you owe back rent?
She has been able to get her kids into an outdoor classroom and has picked up some part-time work just in her building. But her rent is just under $2,000 a month. And now, just over the past year, there's $10,000 of it that she couldn't pay.
It's such a heavy load. She's not being evicted. There are protections for that, but she eventually will need to pay that money back.
Well, yes, at least that's how it looks right now. So like you've been saying, there's a moratorium on evictions for people who have lost income because of COVID-19 through the state through the end of June. So that's protecting her. Under that moratorium, you do need to pay at least 25% of your rent to avoid being evicted on July 1st when this moratorium is set to expire. But even if you do, you will still owe the full amount, even if you can't be evicted for it. Your landlord could take you to small claims court after this emergency period expires or take other measures to get the rest. So Lloyd says she's been very careful about paying at least 25% of the full amount each month to avoid eviction, but she's still afraid of the debt.
The thought of being sued after enduring this is just unconscionable. And so I want to make sure that we're in compliance. I want to make sure to say for certain that my kids and I will be safe and not living in our car.
Anna, I wonder, I mean, we talked about at the outset that there's this state program, right? The billions of dollars of the state is sort of coalescing, right, to make sure that the people who need it get help. Will Kelly Lloyd get help?
Well, maybe. You know, this program is going to start accepting applications on March 15th. So it's a couple of weeks out, and there's some unknowns. It's specifically for low-income tenants who are at risk of becoming homeless due to COVID-19 and the impacts of the pandemic. So Kelly Lloyd's not making much money right now. She's not going to know for sure, of course, until the program is open if she qualifies. The other thing about it is that it's not so much about giving cash assistance to tenants like Lloyd, but really about making their landlords whole on their behalfs. So applications are going to open, and basically landlords whose tenants qualify, who are missing rental income, they can apply and get reimbursed for up to 80% of the back rent that they're owed if the landlords agree to forgive the other 20%. So if this worked out in Kelly Lloyd's case, her landlord could get $8,000 of the $10,000 that she owes and then would have to agree to forgive the remaining $2,000. Now, Lloyd is anxious because she just doesn't know yet if this is going to help her. She doesn't know yet if her landlord will be interested. She's worried that landlords may pick and choose which tenants to keep, although California's largest landlord group, the California Apartment Association, has put out some guidance to its members recently saying that legally they may not be allowed to turn down the assistance because of discrimination rules around sources of income. So, as I said at the outset, there are a lot of questions right now in the couple of weeks before this program rolls out. The last thing to know about it is if landlords don't apply, tenants can take it upon themselves to apply, but may only then apply for that 25% that they need to avoid eviction.
All right, so there is that. I imagine, Anna, that many, many landlords will be interested, though. If they're not getting rental income, they still need to pay their mortgages, their bills, right?
Yeah, and I talked to a local representative for the California Apartment Association who said that most of their members are independent owners who have 10 units or less. Many have lost rental income. I talked to one of those small landlords as well. Her name is Diane Robertson. She owns property in South LA.
You know, as small owners, we are very different from corporate owners. And in fact, we are more similar to our tenants than not.
Robertson said that while all of her tenants have been able to pay full rent through the pandemic, she's a founding member of the Coalition of Small Rental Property Owners, and she hears from a lot of fellow members who operate on small margins and are struggling right now.
Small landlords are not rich. We need help. And many simply cannot continue to house their tenants for free with increasing utility costs, increasing fees.
For example, in the city of LA, some recycling collection fees are set to go up this year. That's one small example. But there hasn't been anything that Robertson describes as meaningful mortgage relief. There has been some foreclosure protections for owners with federally backed loans. But even if you get that, it's often not enough to make up for what's lost.
We rely heavily on rental income, not just to pay the mortgage, but to pay property taxes, insurance, keeping up with the maintenance and amenities on the building, which we are still required to maintain. There just does not seem to be any consideration to this fact by our government.
So, Steve, there's just all kinds of debt piling up right now, both for renters and for property owners. And not just debt related directly to housing either. Credit card debt nationwide hit a record high in February. It was recently estimated that 1 in 8 Californians are behind on their water bills, but there is a temporary moratorium on water shutoffs. So there's kind of this financial cliff coming up when a lot of these things are going to come due.
Anna, I know, there are disagreements, right, about what to do. Tenant advocates have called for canceling the rent, just getting rid of it for now, which obviously landlord groups do not want. There is this push and pull because you just heard the landlord association, right, say that most of our landlords, most of the people who own these buildings are small, mom and pops, 10 units or less. But then you have other folks who say, you know what, there are some large mega corporations that own these gigantic apartment complexes. The basic thing that the people we heard from today seem to agree on is that there's this huge need, though, for direct cash assistance on a large scale to make sure that housing costs are met. That's the basic need for people, right? Instead of just piling up later.
Yes. And this program that is going to start rolling out in a couple of weeks is not going to meet all of the need, but it is the biggest rent relief program we've seen so far, so it'll be interesting to follow that.
And we will, by the way. KCRW's reporter Anna Scott, who covers housing and homelessness. Anna, thank you so much.
Thank you, Steve.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Moving on now with KCRW's Greater LA, I'm Steve Chiotakis. The life we lead right now through this pandemic and otherwise will be told to future generations by the things we leave behind, told by the folks documenting it in writings and films and photographs. One of the people who has documented life in both film and photography is John Simmons. Through the lens of his cameras, he has chronicled everything from the everyday in Black Chicago in the 60s to current day unhoused Angelenos. John's work is seminal, from the civil rights movement to Los Angeles to Hollywood, and he joins me now to talk about those photographs and his work and their impact. Hey, John.
Hello there. Thank you for having me on.
You bet. I mean, when you first started out, what sorts of, see, because I'm looking through some of these pictures. Some of them are everyday life, right? You know, a couple on a bus or a little girl eating an ice cream cone, right? I mean, those are everyday scenes. But then you have pictures from the civil rights movement. You have pictures of Angela Davis. You have pictures of Shirley Chisholm. You have, you know, protests in Georgia over the Voting Rights Act and things like that. I mean, what drew you to the camera?
Well, you know, I was born in 1950. And during the 60s in Chicago, it was a pretty hip period. I mean, the civil rights era was hot. Jazz was there. There was a very passionate cultural thing that was happening. There were hippies. There was a Vietnam War protest. And growing up at that time, you know, I wanted to identify myself with something. And being involved in the arts all my life as a child and being attracted to that kind of expression, I wanted to find my way. I wanted to be a musician. I wanted to be a poet. I wanted to be all those things. And a friend of mine's older brother was a photographer. His family owned the Chicago Daily Defender newspaper, the oldest black newspaper in the country. Bobby Sengstack was his name. He's a very well-known photographer. His stuff is in the Smithsonian Institute and a number of famous and prestigious institutions. And, you know, as a teenager, I used to think that Bobby was one of the hippest cats I knew. He had cameras hanging all over his shoulder. He worked in a dark room with jazz playing. And his brother and I used to admire him. And one day he let me borrow his camera at a convention of the, it was called the Negro Publishers Convention. It was in 1965 in New York. And he gave me a camera. And I went around the room taking pictures, and he saw the photographs and said, "My God, you got an eye." And I fell in love that day looking through the camera, and it was something that I could do, and it came natural to me. And eventually, I began to work for the newspaper, and by the time I was 16, I was taking pictures for them. And eventually, I went to study cinematography at the University of Southern California. And today I'm working as a cinematographer and carrying my camera every day as I always did.
Well, you work in Hollywood now. You know, you said you went to USC cinematography, that eye, right? And I wonder, like, when you look back at some of the pictures that you took of the civil rights movement, of the heavy hitters of the day, or even the everyday, when you talk about that eye, what is it you're looking for?
Well, you know, when I look back at the pictures that I've taken in the past, here's something I want to share with you, is every time I hit the shutter and take a picture, it's a total accumulation of everything I've ever done and who I am at that moment. So when I look back at those photographs, that's a different cat taking those pictures, you know, and fortunately, there's a continuum. I can see the consistency of visualization through the different periods. But when I think back on those photographs, I think back on how fortunate I was to be able to be in those places and to be able to work for a newspaper that sent me on assignments and to be able to receive that scholarship to Fisk University at a time where the culture was so rich and rewarding and people from every walk of life showed up at that university. And it was a community that, you know, was still mostly segregated, just as Chicago was the most segregated place I've ever been pretty much during that period. But you're in this community, you're isolated. It's an embracing community where people actually supported each other at that time And everyone was like an extended family. They weren't afraid of a camera because there was no social media, you know, out to attack someone. So when I walked through the streets with my camera, there was a different kind of courage that everyone shared and a different kind of, you know, relationship.
Did you feel shielded by that camera? If you're taking a picture of a civil rights protest in Georgia, what'd you think? I mean, did you feel like your life was in danger? What did they say things to you?
I can imagine they did. I felt like it was very dangerous. The one photograph called Macomb, which is a portrait of a man with police standing behind him, is in Macomb, Georgia. And there's two policemen in that shot. And behind the policeman, there's another man that has on a baseball helmet. And who he is a deputized truck driver. And the truck drivers were deputized to control this peaceful crowd. So shortly after I took the photograph of that man, a cop, one of those cops, hit me across my back with a billy club. I fell to the ground, and when I rolled over and looked at him, his face was 6 inches from my face, and he was telling me, don't let the sun set on me, right? But I'd also photographed the 1968 Democratic Convention in Chicago, which was also dangerous. So yeah, I've been chased out of areas. I've been escorted by the police out of areas. And that just kind of went with the job. And not only that, but during that period, I felt like it was necessary to tell the story. So there was a bit of adrenaline that went with that whole feeling, too. And I was young, so I was bulletproof, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, as young people are, right? Invincible.
Right. Exactly. But not now, because during the protest for George Floyd at the height of the pandemic, I went out to take pictures, but I was very cautious, not because of the police, but because of the virus. So every time I'd go out and take pictures of those events, as soon as it got a little too crowded, I was back in my car, you know?
But when you look at those photographs that you took last summer of the protests, the George Floyd protests, versus the pictures you took in the 1960s, Macon, Georgia, you know, the Chicago Democratic National Convention, things like that, the civil rights strife that was going on at the time. How are they different and how are they the same?
Well, they're the same because both situations speak of the need for change, you know, and people are passionate. And not only that, but now is a different period because now images speak to the world. You know, they speak to the world. I mean, you look at the girl that shot George Floyd dying, right? That moment that girl put on her phone reached everyone in the world. So there's a difference there. And as far as my images go, basically, I'm attracted to those events for the same reasons, because I'm moved by change. I'm moved by the importance of the message. And the difference is, social media is now an outlet before it wasn't.
Well, speaking of which, you have a show over in Boyle Heights at a place called Casa 0101, right?
Yeah, it's a show called Capturing Beauty, the Artwork and Photographs of John Simmons. And it has about 35 photographs and three of my collages. I've also been making collages since the 70s. And if people go to that website, it's casa0101.org. They can register for the Q&A. And there's a tour of the exhibit where I talk about the photographs.
I want to thank you. What a pleasure talking to you. John Simmons, photographer, award-winning cinematographer, and director here in Los Angeles. Thanks for your time. Good luck to you, sir.
Thank you very much. And check out the exhibit.
This is Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Voters promoted former Orange County Supervisor Michelle Steele to Congresswoman last November, sending her to Washington. Now there's a special election to replace her on the OC Board of Supervisors. Let's head down to the County of Orange. There are five candidates in the running to represent District 2. The last day of voting is next week on March 9th. That's a week from tomorrow. LA Times columnist Gustavo Arellano is here to tell us more. Hey, Gustavo.
Hola, Steve.
Let's talk about District 2. So what does it encompass?
District 2 is going to be Newport Beach, Costa Mesa, Huntington Beach, part of Westminster, not all of Westminster. So it's going to be central Orange County heading towards the coast. So more Republicans are registered there than Democrats, but it's also, you know, like almost all of Orange County, it's increasingly becoming purple.
All right. So let's talk about the candidates in the race. There are three Republicans, two Democrats. Let's start with the Republicans who are in the race. Tell us about them.
The most prominent name, of course, is John Morlock, who was a longtime supervisor, lost in 2020. He was a state senator, but lost to a Democrat. This is a guy, of course, most famous for predicting the 1994 Orange County bankruptcy. So this is, I mean, rock rib Republican. So it's interesting then that he has, two Republicans going against him. The lesser one known is the mayor of Fountain Valley, Michael Vo. No one really knows why he's running, but he's running. But the one that makes a little bit of sense is Mayor Pro Tem of Newport Beach, Kevin Muldoon. He was actually planning to run in 2022 when Michelle Steele would have been termed out. So he's been raising money for these past couple of years. Now, all of a sudden, there's a special election. He's like, well, I might as well run.
Is there a favorite among the three there?
It'll be hard because, again, Morlock is that name in Orange County politics, one of the legends, really, of the past 25 years of the Republican movement. But also because you have divisions within the Republican Party, there's accusations, maybe it's his time to step aside. Kevin Muldoon is up and coming, younger, move it around. The Republican Party of Orange County has endorsed Morlock, but they're not. You know, in previous years, they would have reprimanded anyone trying to run and divide the vote. But in this case, that hasn't happened with Muldoon.
Do you think that spells trouble then for a Republican trying to win that seat?
Yeah, it's going to be hard because, the Republican vote's most likely going to be split, especially in Little Saigon. Michael Vo's of Vietnamese descent. So he's going to get a lot of those Vietnamese voters. Muldoon's probably going to get his Newport Beach crowd, and then probably Morlock will get the rest of them. So I think he'll win among the Republicans. But now, because the vote is so diluted, will that mean that he'll be able to get more votes than the main Democrat in the race, which great segue to Katrina Foley?
There are two Democrats in the race, Foley being one of them. Who's the other?
Janet Rappaport, she's saying a nonpartisan race, has never run for election, no one knows who she is. She's one of these candidates. Hey, because American democracy is so wonderful, if you're eligible to run in an election, you're doing it. That's exactly what Janet's doing.
All right, let's talk about Katrina Foley then and her, I guess, imprint on Orange County.
Liberal lioness of Costa Mesa, longtime member of the city council, also the school district there with Newport Harbor, which is also Costa Mesa as well. She's currently the mayor, but every time she's tried to go for higher office, she's lost. As recently as 2020, she tried to run against John Morlock for his state Senate seat, and she lost there. Here, it seems like this is going to be the best chance ever for her to be able to go up to higher office. And the Democrats are banking everything on her, and they have been for a while, because if she wins, that means the vote in the Orange County Board of Supervisors will be 3-2 Republican instead of the current 4-1 Republican. And that one Democrat there up in Fullerton, he's kind of a more conservative one. Katrina, on the other hand, total progressive, total everything that Republicans in Orange County hate.
So this is sort of like Morlock versus Foley again.
Oh, it'll be interesting because maybe the young guns of the Republican Party, they go more for Muldoon, and then Morlock plays a spoiler. Remember, this is a special election, though, especially in Orange County. People have been able to vote ever since the beginning of February. Usually when it comes to mail-in elections, historically, Republicans have been better. But of course, this past 2020 has shown again that the Democrats are ascendant in Orange County. But I would still say Katrina wins only because the Republicans have split it amongst themselves. And if that happens, well, the Republican Party is going to have another reckoning with itself in Orange County.
That's your official prognostication. How does this special election work, Gustavo? I mean, is it just the person who gets the most votes wins?
Yeah, it's a one and done because it's a special election. So whoever wins, wins, one and done.
Again, voting going on now, but voting will wrap up a week from tomorrow, March 9th. Gustavo Arellano, columnist with the LA Times. Every week, he's with us with the KCRW Orange County line. Gustavo, thanks.
Gracias.
That's going to do it for us this evening. Tomorrow, our Wasted series continues, and designing a world with less packaging. Right now, things, many, many things, are shipped right to your door. Those things come with other things to assure your thing's safe arrival, like packaging and bubble wrap and paperwork. Oh, my. You'll hear about that tomorrow on this program. Check out our website, kcrw.com/greaterLA. Hear the stories of LA, the people who make up this place, and the places that make the people of LA and beyond. Subscribe to the podcast, have it delivered to your feed on the regular too at kcrw.com/greaterLA. Jenna Cagle, Catherine Barnes, Sonia Geis, PJ Shahamat, Ray Guarna, Phil Richards, Amy Ta, Mario Saavedra, Mike Stark, and Christian Bordahl. We're all here putting this show together tonight. I'm Steve Chiotakis, honored by your presence and support. Have yourself a great night.